This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. You know, often when I watch that ad, it just makes me feel, well, I need to say something because Investec are my own bank and they're amazing. They're not paying me to endorse them, but just about every time I have something to do with the guys there, they just uplift my spirits that a South African business can be so excellent. Ah, well done, guys. And I've been a happy client of that bank for, must be going on for, well, some decades, let's put it that way. And in business banking, they really do deliver the goods. So if you're ever considering moving, as I say, our marketing team haven't told me to say this, but I can endorse them. Someone else I can endorse is my colleague, Christine. Man, that Sunday show that she has with Neil de Beer, whose favorite word seems to be moer. And he says that's to do with coffee and not with the rude one, although he uses it interchangeably. But Chris and Neil have got just the most wonderful chemistry and rapport. But she's not a one-trick pony by any means. Yesterday, Chris spoke with Glynis Breytenbach and I know we all call, in politics anyway, Helen Ziller the Iron Lady of the Democratic Alliance. Well, I'll tell you what, Glynis has got to be the Steel Lady then if the other one's Helen's the Iron. And my goodness, if she could get her hands on a serious portfolio, I would be betting that this former prosecutor at the National Prosecuting Authority would really shake things up in South Africa. Anyway, Chris and Glynis had a fabulous conversation. The recording is on BizNews TV on YouTube. We're going to take a couple of clips from it, and starting off with the rumors that abound that are heading into 1994, the old apartheid government, the National Party, and the incoming government, the African National Congress, had a lot of secrets that they didn't want the rest of the world to know about. So they hid them and made sure that they never came to light. Well, there is a lot of conversation now about revisiting that and seeing exactly what happened at the time. Let's listen in on Glynis and Chris.
Glynis, what about the allegation that has persisted for decades that the National Party and the African National Congress cut a deal, a secret deal, to avoid prosecutions on both sides? We know your secrets, you know our secrets, and let's protect one another.
You know, it's not impossible, I suppose. Of course, we've all heard those rumors many times. It's just so, well, I mean, it would leave me feeling used and abused as a lawyer, certainly as a prosecutor. I would be very angry if that was true. And I imagine South Africans would be very angry, and they would be entitled to be so. If we were starting over in 1994, if we were, you know, wanting to be that country that stunned the world by doing a peaceful transition and building, and largely we've succeeded in building a country for all South Africans. No, nobody can, I don't think anyone would argue that South Africa today is a better place than South Africa pre-1994. If such a deal was cut, well, I hope it's not the case, is all I can say. I hope it's not the case. I don't know what the explanation would be for the delay. I have no idea. I've tried to think of logical, good explanations. I have not yet come up with one. But if that is the case, that is so cynical, so flying in the face of everything that this democracy was built on, accountability, the rule of law, a fine, fine, fine constitution, to sweep those types of things. You know, what was the point of the TRC then, to just, you know, sit there and really put people through a harrowing experience, because it was harrowing, I think, for everybody. Harrowing for the victims, harrowing for their families, harrowing for South Africans who were largely ignorant of those goings on. What was the point of that if there was going to be no accountability afterwards? So I sincerely hope not.
Well, if it were to have been the case that there were secrets that were hidden at the time, you can be sure that they will come to light, because there is nothing more powerful than the truth. We got a lot of truth bombs in the Zondo Commission. The problem there was that although many criminals have been exposed, they walk among us in their Gucci suits and driving their Ferraris and their Lamborghinis with ill-gotten gains, primarily from We the People. This is another subject that Chris raised with Glynis.
Well, now people are asking the same question, Glynis. What was the point of a Zondo Commission? Is the Zondo Commission in danger of becoming another TRC, just a show commission?
Well, it can't be. We can't allow that. Can't allow that to happen. The Zondo Commission was done over a very long period of time. Chief Justice Zondo worked, you know, miracles with that commission, obtained the most startling evidence. It's all there. It's all available. And it needs to be dealt with. And again, time is marching on. We've yet to see even one successful Zondo prosecution. And we've yet to see even one notable state capture prosecution. I'm not talking about the rats and mice stuff. That's easy to do. But, you know, there's not even one case that we're aware of that is being built from the ground up that we can, you know, take comfort in the fact that, you know, sometime this year it will come to court and be successful. We don't see that happening. So the you know, the Ace Magashule case is now running in the Free State. Advocate Nazir Kassim SC is prosecuting it. He's leading the prosecution. He's a man of integrity, unquestionably so. He's a competent lawyer in every aspect. So, you know, one must hope that this one will be the one that is successful. But one's, you know, swallow. Yeah, in 30 years, that's it, one. But, you know, one swallow doesn't make a summer. We need Zondo cases to be prosecuted, you know, because we need people to be held accountable for hollowing out the state resources and selling off state resources to the highest bidder and enriching themselves and a very small group of people at the expense of the entire South African population. People need to be held accountable for that. It's a gobsmackingly serious issue.
It really is, in this republic of no consequences that we've become so used to. I love people like Glynis Breytenbach raising their voices, the whistleblowers who do that as well. But we the people so often get distracted and we forget about these ills that have been perpetrated on society. Let's hope that Nazir Kassim SC is successful with the very first Zondo Commission prosecution, and that that opens the floodgates for other civic-minded lawyers and advocates to jump into the ring and to say, I'll help. I'll also do some prosecutions, because, man, the evidence, as Glynis says, is there. Well, moving across the ocean now to the United States, when Donald Trump brought in his so-called Independence Day with Trump tariffs, the stock market cratered in anticipation of a knock to the global economy. But as our partners at the Financial Times of London discussed this morning on the FT News briefing, it's recovered. Mr. Market is once again quite firmly balanced with both feet on the ground. Let's have a listen to Mark Filippino and his colleagues.
Trillions of dollars in value disappeared from the stock market after so-called Liberation Day. That was April 2nd, the day that U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled his global tariff policy. The S&P 500 tanked by as much as 15% in a roller coaster ride of trading in the days after. But now the major indices are pretty much back to where they were before Trump launched his trade war. My colleague Kate Duguid has been tracking that progress, and she's here with me now. Hey, Kate.
Hi.
So Friday was a big day on Wall Street, and it kind of puts a point on this run we've been seeing in equities. The S&P 500 jumped 1.5%. What were investors so excited about at the end of last week?
Investors were excited about some strong job market data that came out on Friday morning, which had also affirmed some second-tier job data that had come out earlier in the week. Basically, we saw the data over the course of the week painted a picture of a labor market that remains resilient. That's also, you know, we haven't seen huge impacts on earnings yet. At least for now, tariffs have not necessarily been affecting economic data very much.
Okay, so that explains last week, Kay, but why have indices more generally recovered their earlier losses?
You know, there's hope that a lot of these trade deals will get done in the coming months, that we will see lower tariffs on China, and that there has been a little bit of a detente between the two countries, and that across the board, there will be these sort of one-off trade deals with all of our trading partners. So there's hope that this will be resolved, that the tariffs will not stay in place as written. The question is whether or not that's somewhat unfounded and whether or not the even 10% tariffs will have a significant impact on earnings, on the labor market, and on the U.S. economy more broadly.
Do you think the global economy is out of the woods yet? You mentioned a lot of this reaction is to backward-looking data.
We are definitely not out of the woods. You know, just because the effects of tariffs have not yet shown up in the economic data doesn't mean that they won't. We know that a lot of companies in their earnings guidance have said that they have no idea sort of what to expect in coming quarters. They've pulled guidance or they've offered sort of different scenarios, like United Airlines offered two different scenarios for their year ahead. One was if tariffs stay in place, and one was if tariffs are dramatically reduced. So there's a lot of uncertainty. And I think that investors may be buying the dip, may be trying to take advantage of some short-term moves right now. But I don't think that this is the end of the ructions in the market.
What does all the volatility from the past few months tell you about trading in the age of Donald Trump and Trump tariffs?
So one thing that's crazy is that political headlines matter so much more to the market than they normally do. And they matter more than earnings. They matter more than economic data. You know, I was talking to an investor a week or two ago who said that, you know, normally he's glued to his Bloomberg, but he is spending just as much time following these headlines that come out of DC every day. The difficulty with that, though, is that it's far less certain. It's far less concrete than economic data. So I think that we'll see a lot of continued volatility, and it's going to be a lot of people guessing what they think particular political moves mean, rather than having more certainty on sort of the direction of the economy, as would be the case if you were following just the economic data.
That's the FT's Kate Duguid. She's our U.S. markets editor. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Kate Duguid suggested there quite strongly that political headlines are now more important than the business headlines when it comes to investing. And you have to believe that that's been the case in South Africa for a long time already. In many ways, BizNews started off as a business title. We focused on business, we focused on investment, but it didn't take terribly long in this 11-year-old company's history for us to realize that if you don't get the politics right, well, what chance have you got in business? So pay attention to the political economy first, and things will flow from that. Reason for that is that we are a developing country, and every developing country, P is greater than E. Politics greater than economics. Maybe the US is becoming a developing country too under the mercurial Donald Trump. Australia is a country that we know very well here in South Africa. Many family members have gone over there. Many South Africans see it as a place for a different, certainly a different future. But over there, the house prices have been extraordinarily strong. The Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, was re-elected in a landslide when he was expected, this left-of-center government, to actually get a drubbing just a few months ago. Donald Trump has really turned a lot of things on their heads as far as the international political scene is concerned. The center-rights are doing very well still in Latin America, for instance, but Canada and now Australia, not so much, where the incumbents are actually benefiting from concerns amongst citizens about what Donald Trump's closed economy, closed global economy, might mean for them. But our partners at Bloomberg had a close look at the promise by Albanese on housing prices, or indeed on the housing stock, and how the new government, or the re-elected government, was going to address this. It's an important subject for many in South Africa, because not only do they have family over there, but there are a few of our countrymen who are even thinking of making a new home to that side, to the eastern side of our nation. I guess you, after listening to this, you're going to have to pause.
It's a crisis years in the making. Nationwide home prices in Australia are higher than ever. Rents are at record levels and homelessness is rising. In Sydney, the average home costs almost 14 times the annual disposable income, making it the world's second most expensive city to buy property after Hong Kong. It's not just the bigger city that's expensive. Home prices in Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth have surged between 70 and 75% over the past 5 years to reach record levels. Prices have climbed so much that it now takes the average Australian buyer around 10 years to save a 20% deposit for a medium-priced home, double what it was in 2010. The single biggest reason for the affordability crisis is that Australia hasn't been building enough homes to keep pace with its population increase. Record levels of immigration since borders reopened after COVID have laid bare the poor supply of housing. Pressures include overly complex and slow approval systems, a shortage of building materials and labour, and opposition to development by local residents, known as NIMBYism, which stands for Not In My Backyard. Economists say that two controversial tax settings making it very attractive for investors to buy property are also fueling prices.
The government sets the rules of the game. And the problem in Australia is that the rules of the game have not been properly set, and they've been based entirely on profit rather than balanced with the needs of people. That's the fundamental problem.
Having secured a landslide re-election, the Labor Party has promised 5% deposits for all first home buyers, 100,000 new properties at a cost of $10 billion Australian dollars for first homeowners. It's also targeting to build 1.2 million homes by the end of this decade.
A lot of mortgage holders and renters voted for the Labor Party, so that could definitely embolden them to go forth with trying to actually achieve more of those plans around increasing supply, which is really sort of key from here if we're to see more sustainable growth in home prices in the next 5 to 10 years.
Heidi Stroud-Watts, Bloomberg News, Sydney.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Nice piece, Heidi. Thank you. Still with the partners, our partners at Bloomberg, one of the constituents of the BizNews portfolio that has done well for us over the years, but not so much lately, is Apple. Steve Jobs' company that he created. And in this clip, Bloomberg's Mark Gurman discusses how Apple has got its back against the wall right now.
Mark, in this week's Power On newsletter, you write that Apple faces like a make or break moment, a laundry list of once in a decade problems hitting at the same time. Tariffs, front and center, but so much more, Mark.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Apple is able to deal with a lot, right? But right now they have, I would say, more than a lot going on. They have tariffs, right? That could upend product pricing, device planning, its supply chain. You had a judge in California rule last week that Apple must stop charging developers for in-app purchases completed outside of the App Store. Obviously, the vast majority of revenue Apple gets from the App Store is in-app purchases. That's why Apple tried to protect that 27%, 30% commission at such an extensive level. You have the threat of losing another $20 billion business, the search deal with Google. Google obviously pays Apple that much to make the Google search engine the default provider on the Safari web browser across all of Apple's products and services. And so that is another lever that could potentially hurt Apple. Mm. You have the ongoing struggles in AI. You have the developer conference in June. You have the ongoing DOJ lawsuit. You have increased scrutiny happening in the European Union, in Korea, in Japan. Constantly new threats of fines for a large percentage of their local businesses. And of course, the backdrop is the company's performance in China, yeah. Where a turnaround is very much needed after continued annual declines there.
Well, it maybe is time to take the advice of the Obas of Omaha, as you heard in the last day or so and on yesterday's briefing. Warren Buffett is finally at 94 stepping away from his company. He says, time to be greedy is when everyone is fearful, and the time to be fearful is when everyone is greedy. That's on the stock market. Right now, people are pretty fearful about Apple. Someone who's also fearful, but with good cause, is the people in South Africa who have been working in the movie industry. It's been a booming sector for this country. Anand Singh was, the pioneer in this in Durban, where he built VideoVision into a global player. But since then, we've not only seen that company expanding, but also elsewhere in the country, the movie industry is doing very well. And then along comes Donald Trump. Apparently, he met with some friends who are involved in Hollywood, John Voight being named as one of them, and has come out with an idea that he should be taxing foreign movies and foreign production 100%, supposedly to protect Hollywood. Again, here's the story from our partners at Bloomberg.
Look, this feels, this Truth Social post where we learn about a potential 100% tariff has more questions than answers for the industry right now.
Without question, a lot of people were thrown off guard, very confused. By what exactly it meant and also what Trump's real intentions are. You know, based on our reporting, we know that he spent some of the weekend with actor John Voight and Voight's manager, Stephen Paul. John Voight is one of kind of Trump's ambassadors to try to figure out how to bring production back to this country. Keep in mind, there's still a lot of production that happens in the United States, but there has been a lot of production that has moved to places like the UK and Canada. Mm. You know, I think they talked about things like incentives, but Trump loves a tariff, and so he started talking about tariffs.
More stick than carrot. And so we see who most implicated here, because Barclays already coming out with a note basically saying we export more than three times than we import in terms of movie making, and you're hurting the very industry you're trying to help.
Yeah, the Motion Picture Association, which is the trade group that represents all the Hollywood studios, has not said anything publicly, but they do have reports where they show that the U.S. is a net exporter, that we have a positive trade balance with every other country. You just think about it, the biggest, highest grossing movies of the year, every year, tend to be U.S. movies. You know, the most watched TV shows, the most popular streaming services, all of these are American products for the most part. You know, in terms of the impact, it's really hard to know without knowing how the tariffs would be applied. A lot of people have asked me, like, how do you even tariff a movie? And I'm not sure what to tell them.
Hmm. Well, one of our international licenses is with The Economist, and it has been a favorite publication of mine for decades. More recently, the podcasts that are produced by The Economist have become required listening within the BizNews environment. And it's not surprising because they really are at a different level. One that has been released this morning deals with the challenge of plastics, which on the one hand, have been incredibly supportive of the environmental case by removing the need for harvesting from the natural world, things like ivory and just think of other items that come from that had to be created from nature, like rubber, I guess, with rubber trees and so on. But on the other hand, there is a lot of unhappiness about what plastics is doing to the environment. Many people viewing it as an environmental disaster that blights landscapes and chokes our marine life. The Economist's podcast called The Intelligence, which is a daily podcast, spoke with Rachel Dobbs, who's the environmental editor at the publication, and I've pulled a clip for you with the highlights of that conversation.
Environmentalists really hate plastic. In part, that is because discarded plastics blight otherwise lovely landscapes. You find them in rivers and choking ocean life. But also, increasingly, it is because we are aware that they break into invisible fragments, which have been found in rain, in food chains, and in human brains after they've entered the food chain.
Rachel Dobbs is The Economist's environment editor.
But I think that a lot of times they're too hard on plastic. Plastic is a miracle material, and without it, the world would be significantly worse off. The problem is how we deal with it, and if you're thinking that the answer to the problem is just recycling, it's probably not true.
What is the fix here?
So better recycling is part of the solution, and that should also probably be augmented by advanced recycling, which is a new form that is becoming more popular in which you are using chemical processes to break down plastics into the actual feedstock so they can be made into entirely new plastics. But also, what the world needs to get more comfortable with are the solutions that have previously been really unpopular. So landfill should be a huge part of it, and so should burning plastic for energy.
Both of those solutions have been demonized by environmentalists and others as exactly the wrong thing to do with plastics.
The thing to remember here is that if managed correctly, these are good solutions. So landfill, what correct management means is making sure that they are properly lined, so that you are not getting chemicals and microplastics leaching into the environment, making sure that you are pumping off the gases that the plastics give off as they decompose. So methane is a big one. And that will require proper infrastructure and careful monitoring for a long time, because as we know, plastics stick around for a long time. And that requires investment and is somewhat hard to do, but it is better than failing to do recycling well, as is the case in many poor countries that don't have the resources to do it properly.
And incineration, there are arguments for that too.
Yeah, incineration, again, has been really unpopular because of fears about the toxins that it gives off and also the carbon that it gives off. And both of those things are true, but we now have the technology to manage those much more efficiently. So again, you're capturing any kind of runoff, but you can also capture the carbon that comes off that. And then if you are also using the incineration of this burning waste for energy, you are then getting an energy source which doesn't require burning fossil fuels. But very few countries around the world are really comfortable with this. You have some. China does a lot of it. Japan does a lot of it. The EU increasingly does quite a lot of it. But it is still broadly quite reviled elsewhere, and that really shouldn't be the case. This is going to be costly and difficult, but it will be less costly and difficult than trying to move to other types of materials. And it is worth investing in because plastics do give us so much. We just need to work out a better way to deal with them at the end of their life cycle so that those benefits can continue being gained.
In journalism, we talk about the two faces of Janus, and what you should try and do is to give both sides of the story. We'd really strive for this at BizNews. The Economist does it brilliantly. Well, that's been your briefing for today. Look forward to being back in your company again tomorrow. Until then, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.